This episode is brought to you by HP Plus. In a world full of smart devices, isn't it about time your printer got smart too? Now printing is smart with HP Plus, and the HP Smart app is how it all happens. You can print from your phone with just a tap, no matter where you are, even from your garage / home office / yoga studio. Huh, that is smart. HP Plus. Learn more about smart printing at hp.com/smart. This episode is brought to you by PayPal. These days, choices are everywhere. Like, for instance, the milk in your coffee. Would you like it from a cow? A nut? A tree? Everyone wants options. And now your customers have a new option in the way they pay. With PayPal in person. Just generate your unique QR code in the PayPal app for them to scan. And start accepting PayPal in person today. Learn more at paypal.com/US/getQR code.
Welcome to the Washed Up Emo Podcast. This is the first one of hopefully many. My name is Tom Mullen. I run washedupemo.com, which has been a blog I've done for 5 years or so. And as my co-host, Mr. Raymond Harkins is here as well.
Welcome, Tom. This is a fun endeavor, and I'm very excited to be doing it with you and seeing what else we can accomplish with this fun endeavor.
Yeah, I feel like... You know, I think there'll be people out there. I know that you guys are listening right now, but don't worry. Plenty of your friends will be on board next week and the following week. And, we have a lot of, I think, really interesting things to chat about, and guests from the emo post-hardcore scene and sort of the history. And hopefully through these episodes, we can kind of give a breath of where these bands came from, what their knowledge was, where they are today, and sort of hopefully, if you're a new listener to this kind of genre music, you can kind of tell the past. And you know, that's kind of where I'd like to see this thing go.
Yeah, I think it's I myself am a avid podcast listener, and I know you dabble in it as well. And I just think it's cool because I've never personally listened to a podcast that has dedicated itself to a genre of music. You know, you have like Alternative Press has a podcast where they interview artists and stuff like that. And it's not going to be unlike what we do, but, you know, it obviously focuses on such a wide breadth of music. And so I think just this is cool because this is a genre of music that a lot of people, you know, hold very dear to their hearts. Yeah, I just think it's cool that, you know, we have the ability to kind of explore that with the people who, you know, helped build it from the ground up.
Yeah, and it's been funny to feel people that have responded on washedupemo.com with comments, or they've come up to me at shows or the DJ night that we're doing once a month in New York City. It's funny. Everyone has this really personal connection to it, and they want to express it. And I think a lot of these bands... enough time has passed where they're okay to chat about it. And what's interesting is we're in a great position, Ray and I, where we're able to, we've dealt with a lot of these bands previously or through other bands. And so the lineup of guests that we have coming, I think is, people are going to be really, really excited about. And obviously I don't want to speak before we get them, but definitely the cream of the crop will be on board to chat.
Yeah, definitely. How about you, Tom, you can walk through kind of, you know, your own history of within the not only, you know, kind of where you discovered emo, but like what you've done, you know, professionally and how connected you've been with music for a long time.
Yeah, definitely. It's funny, I was going to punk rock shows in Vermont and hardcore shows, and I had never seen like a major label band I didn't have access to the bands that came on MTV and, you know, seeing Nirvana and those kind of things. They never came to Vermont. I never got to see them. And I only saw punk rock, hardcore, those type of bands. And that's what I got into. And I feel like from the hardcore scene, kind of delved into post hardcore. And when I got into college, thank God, I went to school at this like small college in North Carolina, and a friend brought me to see Bad Religion, and it was like the biggest show I'd seen. I thought it was the greatest thing ever. I bought an extra large shirt because back then that's all they had.
That's all you wore.
That's all you did.
I was actually having a discussion with a friend the other day about this because I'm so pissed because I feel like my parents served me wrong. You were in college when you were buying these extra large shirts, right?
Yes.
Okay. I was in high school when I was because I was raised in a more a place where that had a lot of shows, like Southern California, Orange County. We had a lot of shows, so I got into it. Going to shows when I was like 16, 17, and I was so pissed because all of my shirts are extra large, and I'm like, why did no one tell me that these shirts did not fit me? But I mean, like you said, a lot of these bands never even made shirts that were smaller than larges, so.
No, and that's what you bought. I remember, I mean, that Bad Religion shirt, I can't believe I wore that. But I did. And I think from that, it was really funny. The radio station, I went up there and I felt like I had a lot of records and I had the like hardcore show down, and I pitched to have the specialty show and I got it. And I remember going to the music director's office and there was a box of CDs, and I went in there and I said, "Hey man, how's it going?" And there was a box of CDs and vinyl, and I go, "What's this?" And he goes, "Oh, it's my giveaway bin." This was like the holy grail of emo. There was mineral stuff. There was mineral CDs, mint vinyl, Jimmy World. One of their I forget the name of it, but it's the one that they actually duct taped themselves. That was in there.
Wow.
Just this treasure trove of. It was like, okay, I mean, I was into it, but seeing these, I had never had access to it because the record stores near me didn't have them, and mail order was kind of, it just, these things weren't as easy to get to or listen to. So I asked him again, I go, "This is the giveaway bin?" And he's like, yeah, go. Okay. And I went home, and that was the start of like me listening to this genre and sort of getting into it and going to shows and kind of progressed into getting into the music industry and working at labels and having my own little career musically. But I mean, it literally started from that box of supposedly giveaway CDs.
That's amazing that it was such a physical manifestation of like starting something, you know? It's like this box was your Pandora's box.
I mean, it had everything in there. It had the first Promise Ring record. It had Vitreous Humor. I think it had, what else did it have in there? A lot of Crank stuff. I know this music director well. I still talk to him. His name's Mike. He was huge into ska, so obviously this was be nowhere near his realm. And there was some hardcore stuff in there. It was really funny. A lot of those records in there are the first people I spoke to in the music industry that helped me sort of get a job. So this box, I mean, I literally remember looking at it and taking it and bringing it back to my dorm room, and that was it. So anyway, long story short, always check your giveaway bin at the radio station. There might be a new genre.
That's amazing. I love that. My introduction to this genre was definitely through, similar steps as you, as far as, I got into the whole, Fat Records Epitaph scene when I was in like 7th and 8th grade. I distinctly remember getting into the Descendents when I was in 8th grade by watching the movie Pump Up the Volume. And only reason being is because they had a funny song in there. They had the Wiener Schnitzel song in there, and I was like, oh, dude, these guys sound funny. And for whatever reason, I was like super into any like musical humor. Like I was super into Jerky Boys. And so it's like if there was a funny thing that had to do with, music in any way, shape, or form, I'd probably be into it. But anyway, so got into that. Then that progressed into heavier stuff, your typical Victory Records stuff, your Strife, Earth
I forgot to
Crisis.
mention that. Yep, a lot of
Yeah.
Victory. The Victory magazine was a joke slash that's where you got your records.
Oh, it was incredible. I ordered every Christmas holiday. My mom basically was like, "What do you want?" And I was like, "I want everything from here." And like,
We did the same thing. That's the same thing I did. My mom just gave. You're gonna find out, people, that Ray and I are the same people. We just live 3,000 miles away.
so good.
Parents gave me. They were like, "What do you want?" I said, "Give me $100, and I'll just buy whatever I can." at the victory site.
Dude, it was that, and it was so funny opening those presents in front of, like, my grandparents, where it was like, oh, cool, here's a shirt with bulldogs all over it. I'm like, okay.
Cool. Firestorm, sweet.
Exactly. But so yeah, then through that, and it, I don't think I was adverse to listening to music that was softer, but I distinctly remember going through a phase of, like, I don't really want to listen to anything that's, like, not aggressive, and then I just remember buying, because I just, worshipped at the altar of Victory Records, and because that label had such a large reach as far as their musical genres, I started to get into different stuff that they were putting out. Like, I got really into Guilt for a while, and so I think that started to open my musical palette a little bit. But then,
The donuts, right?
or Hi-Fi and the Roadburners, huge.
Huge influence on my life.
And then I distinctly remember buying the Revelation Records in-flight sampler. I mean, that was like $5 at your local record store, and I just bought it because I was like, oh, there's, like, I like Gorilla Biscuits and I like some of these bands. And that's when, obviously, the label sampler was still, a very viable option for discovering new music. And then the Texas Is the Reason song, Back and to the Left. That's where I was like, that is my touchstone of getting me into music that wasn't screaming.
No, definitely.
And
Yeah,
then,
that
yeah.
record was huge. I mean, that the Far Side track on there, the Shades Apart song,
Totally.
it was like that mold of pop, like really catchy tunes, but it wasn't like a, it wasn't top 40.
Yeah, and I felt like it held enough, I guess, for lack of a better term, aggression, even though it was not aggressive by any means. But it was obviously tuneful, and they just were able to kind of combine everything that I was looking for at that time musically. And then, like, once I started to peel away those layers of Revelation catalog, that's when, you got in, like, all those bands you mentioned, Game Face, Sense Field, anything that originated from Rev. And then from there, that's when emo started to hit, as far as, your Get
Cheap
Up,
Tree.
totally, your Get Up Kids and Promise Ring, like, 'cause this was like about 90, I think that comp came out in 97, and so, like, right around then is when everything started to happen on a more national level for that music. But yeah, that's exactly how I kind of peeled away layers for emo. I was resistant at first, but then definitely came around.
Yeah. It the I think the like those record labels, like the Caulfield Records, the Initial Records, what's the one that the Get Up Kids are on? Why am I forgetting?
Doghouse.
Doghouse. All those guys were there and putting out these records, and it was still so word of mouth. You had to go to the show, you had to buy the record. It definitely made it, like a conquest or like a search versus let me just, media fire everything and I have the entire discography in 5 minutes.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I think everybody can wax nostalgic about whatever musical genre they get into being more pure than it is in its current state, but it definitely had this. I think everything was so unintentional with this scene, where it was just kind of like everything kind of led to one another, and it just, everyone kind of tripped onto bands, and those bands started other bands, and I don't know, it just seemed, very different than the way that, I guess, like, punk and hardcore scenes kind of started to spread. Because it seems like those bands really kind of, they were bored suburban kids that kind of had a purpose, whereas I don't know, a lot of the bands that started, like, they kind of just wanted to have an outlet for their emotions as opposed to, pushing a political agenda or whatever.
Yeah, no, I think all those things are it's so funny that I always make fun of, West Coast and East Coast, and it's just we came to that same point just kind of through different labels, but it traveled to the same spot. So I find that really interesting.
Yeah, no, it's it, and that's obviously the reason that we, wanted to come together in the same digital room and obviously shed light to this subject.
And I just wanted to give a little background, just washed up emo. I know it has a funny connotation, but I started it in 07, 2007, just to kind of get out my aggression of this scene sort of falling. And no offense to, the Fall Out Boy dudes. I know the drummer's like into really good bands, and I'm sure that it's just the connotation of it got put to the mainstream. And it really was hard, and with goth and people thinking that cutting and suicide were part of this. And it really came from an indie sort of post-hardcore rock realm and just about the music. And so that's where it started, and it's kind of progressed. And I've had a bunch of different phases in it. And been in the last couple years and kind of sparked this podcast too, was talking about these newer bands that are coming up that are sort of hearkening from that day, not using Ray's last name, but talking about the old sort of and referencing those bands. And it's really nice to hear that it meant enough where it's lasted, and 10 years have gone by where it's people have, I mean, there's still, I mean, I still get reviews I see of like My Chem, and it just says emo, or that's just going to happen because the word is just, it's sort of out there. I just think that if there's a forum to kind of chat and talk about these newer bands who are, they'll rather reference those older bands than newer bands. Just a great opportunity to help those guys out too.
Yeah, definitely.
So
I mean,
that's why I do the site. I do it for fun. I do have a real job. But right now, that is just what I've been doing for fun. So we'll just add this to it.
And I've known Tom. We first ran across each other in about 2007, just through some mutual friends, and then within an hour of meeting one another, we definitely were like, "Oh, dude, you get it. All right."
Yep.
Yeah. And it's like, because you run across those people, it's like, okay, we've had similar experiences, from completely different walks of life as far as where we were raised and our backgrounds or whatever, but we had such similar experiences, and everything that we said, it's like we could fill each other's musical sentences, within, like I said, an hour of meeting each other. So
Very well said. That's exactly it. I think my girlfriend walked away or something at one point. Like, she was so annoyed.
she 100% was. She was like, "Oh God, you guys are just gonna totally bro down all night." And it's like, "Yep, yes, we are."
See ya.
I know, if we were a male and a female, we definitely would be, immediately asking each other back to each other's apartments
Yes.
and playing each other mixtapes.
Oh my God, vinyl. I actually, in college, there was a friend that is in a bunch of bands, but at the time, and he would visit his girlfriend, and she lived a few doors down from me. He would literally come and drive into the apartment complex and not go to her house, but go to my house first because I had the records.
So good.
So he'd be like, "What's coming out? What's the latest?" And I'd tell, and it just, she would get so mad. She's like, "You drove 5 hours and you're not even hanging out with me." And he's like, "But Tom's got the records." So it's funny.
Well, we gotta know where our priorities land sometimes.
Exactly. We need to know what's next. So, would you want to, we can intro the first guest, I guess, right?
Yeah, no, I think so. You know him better than I, Tom, so you can
Yes.
intro him.
Yes, I will. The first guest we have for the podcast is Chuck Daly. He spoke with us recently, and it was basically he was one of the first sort of people that I met at a emo label was Deep Elm, and he did press for Deep Elm for a while, and we used to hang out at festivals and shows and got to be really good friends. And now he runs Bear Trap PR, working with a lot of great bands, and he runs a little label on the side called Tiny Engines, and really insightful about a lot of things from that time period. And it's great to have him on. Chuck, thanks for being on the Wash Up Emo podcast. We met, what, 96, I believe?
No. I didn't start working at Deep Elm till maybe, God, it was 2000 or 2001, so not quite that early.
But I got Camber in the mail when I first got there. But so you weren't even there yet.
I didn't get I mean, I graduated college in 98 and then probably didn't start working at Deep Elm until almost 2 years later. So, yeah, I guess it was probably 2000. I was not there at the beginning when John was in New York. I moved down to Charlotte a couple months after he had moved down here. So,
because that's still
a long time ago, Tom. It's still like 10 years.
Yeah, I guess you're right. It is still a long time ago.
You just fucked up the timeline, dude.
It's, you know what's fine about that is that I'm old and I'm deaf, so that's fine. I mean, I think, you know, one of the first records, I mean, from, you know, Deep Elm was Camber, which I know you're a huge fan of, and all the Mac Rocks that we did, and you were doing a bunch of stuff, the Deep Elm, and then the band I was in college or in New York ended up being on an Emo Diaries comp.
Yep.
Then you jumped ship, and you did Bear Trap and Tiny Engines, so you kind of kept it real, and I just wanted to kind of, you know, go through some of that stuff. I think the first one would be... you know, some of those first bands that you kind of dug growing up that you think kind of helped get you into it and kind of how that came into Deep Elm.
Well, I mean, as far as a Deep Elm angle, that Camber record, Beautiful Charade, was the first thing I ever got from the label. And that definitely helped open my eyes up to, you know, to what John was doing at the time. And, you know, the fact that I even landed a job at Deep Elm was just because I was a fan of the label and just happened to be browsing the website and saw that he was hiring. And it was just sort of a, you know, like I said, I had just graduated college and I'm sort of looking, I didn't know what I was going to do. And it was, I just sent the resume on a whim. But, you know, in terms of growing up, you know, I came from like a pretty small town in Western Maryland, so there wasn't like a ton of shows or, you know, I didn't really have any access to, you know, underground or punk music. So it wasn't like I came from any scene like that. In college, I definitely started getting into punk more. You know, I worked at the radio station and, one of my roommates was really into Bad Religion. So that sort of kicked it off there. But in terms of the whole emo thing, it's funny because it was Braid's Frame and Canvas, but I discovered it because Alternative Press had published an article. I think it was called The New Hardcore.
Wow.
And Braid was one of the bands that was featured. And it was, you know, it was mostly emo bands, but they were calling it The New Hardcore, so I had no clue, you know. And that's Braid's Frame and Canvas definitely kind of kicked it off. And then, you know, like I used to, do you remember that website? It's definitely not around anymore, but it was called Rocket Fuel, and they covered a lot of that genre in the early days.
I don't remember that one.
Yeah, it was, there weren't very many out there. It was like, you know, Rocket Fuel, I think Action Attack Helicopter was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, none of them are around anymore. Splendid. You guys remember Splendid?
Dude, you're blowing my mind. I literally have never heard of any of these.
Yeah, this is why you're on.
Well, this is my job for a lot of years. I mean, you know, starting out at Deep Elm was just, you know, covering all the media stuff. So I'd visit these websites all the time. But even before that, I wasn't living in a place with a scene or anything like that, or even a good college radio station. So, you know, it was the internet that I kind of got my information from.
I just relied on the Revelation Records message board.
Yeah, that was me. And then Victory Records message board. I know that sounds really cheesy, but that had a lot of stuff on there.
Yeah.
So do those message boards go back that far? Because I don't really remember message boards until, I mean, not that long ago.
Message boards for, like, well, for Revelation, I didn't really visit the Victory one, but Revelation, like, that started around, I want to say, between 94 and 96, because, like, I, not only was I getting, like, show information from, like, local, you know, because they actually had, I remember they had a show listing, they had a map of the United States.
That was a huge site. Like, if you got on that, I feel like your show did better.
Totally. And so it's like they had that show listing, and then they also had the message board where obviously people talked about whatever they wanted. And I just remember it was like such a hub because I could book shows for my band. I could find out about new music. And it was like, that was the first site that I remember in my own mind where it was like, I found out about news. But all those other sites you're listing was just like, just didn't pop up on my radar. But obviously, since it was your job, it better have popped up.
Those are more sites that would, you know, they'd review bands and, you know, interview bands. So for me, for that, it was just me trying to discover new stuff that I never heard of before. And you know what I just thought of when you brought up Revelation? One of the other ways I sort of got more into the scene was I would do mail order through No Idea, because they had the magazine catalog things. And, you know, it was back then when you'd get the magazine and send in cash, and, you know, there was no email about it or ordering online. It was all done that way. But, you know, the magazines, I can't remember if they had like articles and stuff in it too.
Yeah, they did. They definitely did.
Yeah, that's what I thought. But then like in the mail order in the mail order section, there was always like a little description next to each item, you know, just like one sentence. And, you know, back then I took a chance on a lot of stuff, and some of it was crap, but some of it was pretty awesome. You know, some of it I still have now and listen to. So
yeah, I love that you hit on that, because I distinctly remember myself looking at descriptions from various the initial records catalog. I just
catalog.
Yeah, very.
Very. I forgot about that.
Those ones were amazing, because you felt like, when you read that description, you were just like, I better fucking like this. I'm ordering it. And it was just so like, yeah, I just,
faith.
Yeah, I remember how intimate it was to feel like, all right, I ordered that record and it's coming to me and I'm really taking a chance on it.
Yeah. There's such a great nostalgia with that. You know, I mean, obviously things are easier now, and it's so, you know, you find new bands with the click of a mouse and you can listen to them, and most of them have their entire record streaming, but there's something really cool about that whole not knowing what the hell you're going to get and just the anticipation.
But also listening to the whole record. I have such a hard time now with, you know, you know, Ray sends me a band or you send me the record and I get, you know, through six tracks and something happens. It's like back then, it's like you put the record on in your room and you sat there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it was like it's not religious, but it was like you took that 45 minutes. And I mean, it's funny, I put on records sometimes and, you know, it'll be on shuffle and it'll play, you know, the 11th track of an album. I know every word. And yes, there's other records that happens to, but I think that time frame, there wasn't any distraction.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's why a lot of people are getting into vinyl again, because there's a disconnect with the whole digital side of things, which, again, don't get me wrong, it's very convenient, especially in, you know, doing what I do. But you know, there's something, I think you said there's something a little bit more intimate about stuff like that. So that's one of the reasons that I started getting back into vinyl big time, was just, I don't know. It was more of an engaging, I don't know. It was just a better experience for me.
Yeah.
So,
and then, you know, some of the, you know, when you were there, you know, at Deep Elm and work on those records, and I mean, did you feel something? I mean, we'll get into the emo diary stuff, but did you like feel like, wow, like this is something that's catching on? Or did it, I mean, I remember those, I mean, some of those years, people, I mean, you were chastised if you said emo.
or did you show up to work crying? That's a better question.
I did.
I had to, you know, every day there was a go cry in the corner session and we wrote poetry. No, I mean, John definitely caught flack for the emo diary stuff. And, you know, in one sense, we were always trying to expand, and not expand too much. But, you know, if you look at some of the later catalog where we're putting on stuff like Latterman and, I don't know, Red Animal War, some of the more punk bands we were working with. I don't know. Emo is just the stuff that both John and I really liked at the time. And we didn't push it that much, except for the emo diaries. I don't know. We tried not to think about it too much. It was just, I mean, you know, people say stuff about John, but I definitely learned a lot. I mean, pretty much everything I know, and it was a great experience. And I loved probably like 90% of the band. So, you know, it was always fun, and it was hard work. I mean, we worked like 11, 12 hours a day, and I don't think I had like a serious vacation for 5 years. But, you know, we did it because we loved it, and we always felt like we were kind of on the verge of something big. And there was years where, you know, where we had like Branson and Appleseed Cast and Planes Mistaken for Stars, and that was kind of before file sharing had really, you know, you didn't really hear too much about it. And it's not like we were selling a ton of records, but we were selling enough records that we could afford to fund, you know, these smaller bands that we really liked. And, you know, we weren't worried about money at the time. And then from there, it just sort of, I don't know at what point exactly it was, but it just started to get worse and worse. I mean, at least in terms of record sales, it was just hard to maintain the label at the pace we were doing. So
would you say that you were working there? Cause you said you started around 2000, right?
Yes.
So would you say that like moment, whatever the 2000, 2001 timeframe, that was like the heyday for Deep Elm? And also how many people ended up working there at any given time? Cause the impression that I always had about Deep Elm was like, dude, maybe one or two people working on it at a time. I didn't get the sense that it was like this, I use the word empire, but obviously that means a different thing to independent music. But, do you feel that was the heyday? And then like how, you know, what did the staff look like there?
Well, you're right about the staff.
It was, okay.
I was there for like seven and a half, 8 years, and you know, for that time, it was always John and I. And then I don't think we had one other full-time employee, Will Miller, who actually does Bear Trap and Tiny Engines with me now. So we've obviously kept in touch. And Will was there for maybe, I don't want to say definitely, but like maybe 2 years, 2.5, 3 years, something like that. And he did most of the mail order stuff. But other than that, it was just John and I and maybe an occasional intern, although those never really seemed to work out very well.
And yeah, you guys were in North Carolina, so it wasn't like Los Angeles or New York where you have kids tripping over each other to intern at record labels.
Yeah. We had one girl, Sarah, who was here for a decent amount of time. And, I think that was towards the end where, you know, I think we would have hired her, but, you know, we just couldn't afford it. But as far as the, you know, the heyday of Deep Elm, I mean, it was definitely good when I first got there. I think maybe, you know, when Appleseed Cast's Low Level Owl came out, that was a big record for us. And I think that was, maybe you can call it the pinnacle of Deep Elm. I don't know. And I'm not saying it went down in terms of quality. I mean, and that, you know, we worked with Latterman, which was a pretty big release for us. Just things weren't selling as much. You know, if we sold, whatever, 2,000 copies of Latterman in 2005, I don't even know when it was, 2006, 2007, you know, I rewind maybe 5 years, and I think we could have sold twice that. And it was just a climate of, like, I don't want to blame it all on file sharing, but, you know, there was a lot of indie record stores that were closing their doors, the whole distro situation was just sort of crap.
The music landscape was changing, and it was,
and I don't, you know, I think John always, he really hated file sharing, and he never really tried to figure out ways to embrace it. Although now, once I left, he sort of took a break for about a year, and now everything he's putting out is mostly digital, and he's focusing a lot on licensing for movies and television. So in that respect, Deep Elm is all digital now, which is funny if you think about it. But
he took that year off to be like, all right, it's about time, I guess I do all this.
Well, he took the year off because I think he was just burnt out and kind of figured that it wasn't, you know, the way that Deep Elm was progressing, he just couldn't keep it alive. And that's, you know, that's one of the reasons I ended up leaving. You know, before that, I sort of saw the writing on the wall, and just in general, I kind of wanted to start my own thing. But I saw the way Deep Elm was going, and I was just like, I better think about this. And you know, so it was totally fine when I left. And I think John was, he you know, it kind of took some of the pressure off of him. You know, he didn't have to worry about what I was going to do.
So, yeah. What, good. What do you think the, cause I, anytime anyone works at a label and for, you know, an extended amount of time, I'm always curious about the, what do you pinpoint as far as being, I guess the biggest selling release while you were there, not even so much maybe number wise, but maybe like exposure or whatever the case may be. I know you referenced Appleseed Cast, but,
yeah, I mean, I think Appleseed Cast has always been Deep Elm's biggest band. But you know, Latterman, I mean, Latterman's, I think, continues to get big because those guys are all playing in bands that are pretty popular right now. Like Phil is in Iron Sheik, and Pat is doing Bridge and Tunnel, and Matt is in, what's Matt's band? Reviver? Yeah. So the legend of Latterman continues to grow, but I don't even think John's I don't even know if he's pressing any records. I know No Idea is doing the vinyl version of a bunch of those releases.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, but when I was there, in terms of our biggest seller, it was Appleseed Cast. And it's funny too, you know, if there's any band people listening, it was just in terms of sales, the biggest sellers were always the bands that toured the most, and Appleseed Cast toured the most. And then, you know, behind them were maybe Planes Mistaken for Stars, and Branson for a while was a decent seller, and Latterman toured a bit too. So, I don't know. you can do well if you get out on the road and you connect, you know, you connect with the fans.
Shocking.
Yeah. I mean, it's not rocket science.
Well, that's kind of a funny point. It's like I deal with a lot of that stuff where, you know, they're wondering why this band isn't selling and all this. It's like they got to go on the road for 3 years. They don't know who they are. And it's like you have to do that sort of, you know, push.
Yeah. And you know, I deal with the same thing at Bear Trap where I'm like, I tell the bands, I mean, I can push your record to press and I can talk about it and you know. I can only harass people so much, and at some point you guys have to do something because it, I mean, number one, if you do, you know, if you tour or at least if you're keeping busy, you know, releasing new material or, you know, making a video or doing something, it gives me something to talk about. And in general, press people want to hear about bands that are active. They don't want to hear about your, you know, your band that plays a weekend show locally once every, you know, 4 weeks or whatever. It's just kind of, no matter how good your band is or how awesome your record is, you know, you got to do something to be successful with it. You know, you can't just sit around. So
were there any, you know, I know there's a bunch of favorites from those eras. I mean, I loved Cross My Heart, obviously Drive Till Morning, Slow Ride, Star Market, I still listen to. Were there any others that kind of didn't get the love that you totally dug?
I always loved Red Animal War, but I think, I mean, there's people who like them. I mean, I don't, who's to say if one band should be big? I don't know. But I love Red Animal War. I always like Settlefish, who are from Italy, and it's always kind of hard to get a overseas band to catch on in the U.S. So that might be one. I don't know, man. There was a lot of stuff that like I said, I really loved most of the records we put out.
Benton Falls, which I got a request for on Thursday
Benton
on emo night.
Benton Falls was a band that kind of just like blew up on their own without, I mean, they did a couple tours and then eventually they broke up pretty quickly. But that was a band, you know, somehow just one of those rare instances where people just caught on to their music and talked about them and people still love that band today. And that label, Count Your Lucky Stars, who's run by Keith, who's in the band Empire.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure he released a vinyl version of both Guilt Beats Hate and Fighting Starlight. So he did. Yeah, that's a band that has persisted despite breaking up pretty early and not really doing much touring. So. But yeah, great band, Fighting Starlight. That's one of my favorite Deep Elm records, definitely.
Yeah, I think if you look at my Last FM, I think they're like Benton Falls is like one of the I think at least top 10 bands for me over the years, which it's kind of crazy to think about. I was like looking at that yesterday and I was like, wow. I mean, I know I played the record a lot, but not that much.
Yeah. It's always interesting to look at your last FM stats to see what you're actually listening to.
Yeah. I mean, some of those other bands, you're totally right. I mean, with the touring and, you know, the bands actually trying to get out there. I mean, that kind of brings up, I mean, the Emo Diaries thing. I mean, the quick story. I mean, I know I sent you the band I was in. You guys sent me a contract. I think I read half of it and signed it, sent it back. I didn't give a shit. I was going to be on Emo Diaries.
Yeah.
You know? Is there any sort of, I mean, was that the same thing with most bands? I was definitely naive, and I loved that it helped us while we were still around. And I mean, guys in that band are now in Robbers on High Street, and kind of melded into that. What was that sort of the same thinking for most of these bands? Or I almost see it as the minor leagues, because you could kind of like pick out the bands that sort of got out of it, maybe sign them to a record and have them tour. Just kind of, I felt like it was kind of the minor leagues of emo.
Yeah, well, you know, in terms of the contract, there really wasn't much to it. So, you know,
I know there wasn't. I'm that thing.
I think the only thing about the contract was that, you know, the song on the whatever Emo Diaries you were on was, it was supposed to be exclusive to that for, I mean, I think it was maybe only 2 years or something, or I don't know, it might have been longer than that, but that was part of the appeal of the Emo Diaries. One of the things that made it popular was that you could only get those songs from the Emo Diaries. So, and then, I mean, that was pretty much it as far as the contract. I think the bands got, you know, like 30 or 60 copies of the record or something to sell, or whatever.
Yeah, I think it was a box. I think I got like 100 or something and was able to use them at shows. No, it was great. It was great promo. I was just laughing because I just remember being like, I don't even care what this says. Like, I want to be on Emo Diaries.
I need to interrupt because I need to reference the fact that I had no idea that you were in a band that played and you got on. Which Emo Diaries were you on, Tom?
7.
And what was the name of your band?
Halifax Code.
Okay, don't fucking keep that shit from our listeners, dude. God.
Look it up, man. There's a lot of information on the web.
No, I just, it's one of those things, like your friends keep certain things from you, and then they just like drop it on you at random times, and it's like, yo, really? Why are you keeping that?
But actually, there's really no information on the Halifax Code on the web.
If you want to look up stuff about Robbers on High Street, there's a lot of stuff. But for us, I mean, it's funny. It's how I met Francis Garcia from Drive Till Morning, who I still keep in touch with and has a studio. And it was kind of funny because he actually reached out to me on email from that, because he's like, hey, you're in New York, we should do a show. And we ended up doing shows together, working together. And he actually, this is another thing, Ray, you might not know, I recorded a solo record in New York.
Oh my God, again.
Francis recorded the solo record.
Blowing my mind left and right.
What was it called? Turn the Knife or something?
Turn the Knife.
Yeah.
That's pretty emotional.
This is the reason I'm doing this.
I may have that record somewhere. I don't know if you actually sent me a physical promo, but it's possible it's in a box somewhere.
If not, it's on SoundCloud, and it's funny how many people play it, and like some foreign country person will say, hey, I heard your record. I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's awesome. Amazing.
I am going to do some research on you after we're off our show. Dude, why was there never an Emo Diaries tour?
That's a great question.
Because it would have been a pain in the ass to do, I guess.
True, logistically.
Yeah, we did a Deep Elm tour. It was the that suicide prevention awareness tour. And I think it was Branson, Red Animal War, Desert City Soundtrack. Oh, there's another band I really love, Desert City Soundtrack. God, I can't remember now. There was like five or six bands, and it was just sort of a disaster. And it was really, I mean, we spent like months and months promoting it and doing, and John booked the tour, and it was, it was the most stressful thing ever. And then the turnout at the shows were just not that great. And I mean, I think tickets were $10. I don't know. It was.
Yeah, it's hard to do that.
I don't know. That was one of the things that made me say I will never ever book a tour ever. So I the people who are booking agents, I mean, God bless them. I tell people that, I tell booking agents that, I was like, I hate your job, but yeah. So that's why there was no Emo Diaries tour, probably.
Yeah.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Before, because I know Tom has a few other questions about the Emo Diary stuff, but rather than ending on a note that might not be positive, because I know there was obviously a lot of controversy, you know, a lot of bands spoke out about appearing on Emo Diaries, you know, after they've signed the contract and if they did everything with you guys, you know, on the up and up, and then, you know, whatever, once this was more so like from, you know, the earlier the whatever volumes 1 through 5 maybe, and granted I have no idea how well they sold as it continued, but some bands obviously spoke out and were like, hey, we don't appreciate the fact that, you know, you guys have sold a lot, and I use that word in air quotes because this is not a video podcast, that you know, you've sold a lot of comps and we don't get anything in return from that. And, you know, some people started to, there was definitely a backlash against Deep Elm, and kind of spiking from the Emo Diaries. Like, you know, what was your experience with that stuff, if you feel comfortable talking about it, of course?
No, I mean, that's fine. I don't really remember that many people being too upset, but it's possible that they were upset with John and I just didn't really know about it. I
mean, that could very well be the case, where it's like,
and it's, you know, if we're talking about the early stuff, it was probably before a time where I even really, like I said, I'd never used to do message boards. So, but I don't, you know, like I said, the band's got free copies of records, and I would assume, I'm not positive, but I would think if there was represses, they would continue to get free copies. I think that was part of the deal.
Sure.
And like I said before, I think it also, it was after a certain amount of time, the bands were allowed to do whatever they wanted with the song. Like, they could put it on something else, which I think is, you know, the Jimmy Eat World song that was on the first Emo Diaries eventually ended up coming out on something else, I believe. So I don't know. I mean, I really don't remember that sort of backlash. I mean, the backlash I remember was just, you know, people hating the Emo Diaries because it was called the Emo Diaries.
Right. Yeah. No, and that could have been all like tied up together. And, you know, when I use the word backlash, it definitely wasn't like the independent music scene was up in arms. But I just remember, like, partially just because I think people like us in the digital room are hypersensitive to everything that's happening. So it's like, you know, you see one post on a message board and you're just like, oh my God, there's beef. There's something that exists there.
If I actually pulled out the Emo Diaries and looked at the bands, maybe I'd remember something. The only like serious beef I ever remember, and it was before I got to Deep Elm, was with the Sam I Am song. Because they ended up putting that song on something else, and John was like, well, you can't do that yet. You know, it's, you know, you're still under contract. And I think he ended up suing them. And I think, I think he probably won. I don't even know what happened with that. Like I said, it was before I got there.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
Yeah. That was the only time I ever really remember. And like I said, I wasn't even there yet, but you know, John told me about it, obviously.
Yeah, like hey, we need to watch out for those Sam I Am guys. They're gonna beat the crap out of us. No, just kidding.
Yeah, right. But you know, I mean, that was also before a time where, you know, it was before iTunes, so there wasn't. I don't know if there was. There probably wasn't any like royalties or anything from sales, but we didn't get any. You know, it's not like we got digital sales either from that. I mean. And I have no idea what the sales numbers on the Emo Diaries were.
You know, yeah,
they did pretty well. I don't think they were like, I will say that, you know, John told me that the Emo Diaries, you know, when that first chapter came out, that kind of saved the label. Cause before that he was, know, he's releasing some good stuff, but the label was sort of faltering and he didn't know what to do. And, you know, he wasn't even real sure that he wanted to name it the Emo Diaries, but he went ahead and did it. And, you know, enough people liked it and enough people hated it that were, you know, that talked about it, that, you know, made it relevant. And he said that definitely kept the label going. So that's kind of like a cool little nugget you might not have known.
Yeah.
The bands on the first one is amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, Jimmy World, Sam A.M., Jejune, Camber, Lazy Kane, which I have another random story. just great, great bands.
Yeah.
And that's back when the days where obviously like label samplers, because essentially, I mean, even though it wasn't a label sampler, it was a sampler. That's
how you learned about bands.
Yeah. I mean, that was like the best discovery tool you possibly could have, because it's like, in my formative music years, Victory Style One, Victory Records put out that was incredible. Like Revelation Records put out that In Flight compilation for their 50th release. And it's like those were tent poles for kids to, you know, mobilize around whatever bands appeared on that. And so I could easily see why Deep Elm could have been, like you said, saved, because they put out this, like, here's a doorway to this musical genre that you might have only had like a topical knowledge of.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, the Emo Diaries were basically just a way for us to help out bands that, you know, we thought that were really cool and had some good, you know, some good songs or good music. But obviously, you know, when you're a small label, and not that Deep Elm was the smallest label, but we were, you know, we weren't at the level of some, we're never at the level of Revelation or Jade Tree or Discord or anything like that. We were a moderately successful indie label. But, you know, at the end of the day, it was just a way to give these bands a chance. Stuff that we thought was cool and that deserved to be heard, you know, we put it out on the Emo Diaries. And there's really no criteria. Like, we never said, oh, you have to be emo. You know, you have to have that quote-unquote emo sound to be on this compilation. We just really put stuff on that we liked. And if you look, you know, especially in like the latter chapters, there's a lot of different sounding stuff on those. You know, it's not the typical emo sound. And that was, you know, obviously, you know, we sold copies of the Emo Diaries, and like I said, it helped keep the label relevant and afloat. I mean, in terms of sales, I don't know if it contributed that much, but it, like I said, it kept the label relevant. But at the end of the day, you know, it was something we enjoyed doing, and we liked giving these young bands a voice where they, you know, they might not have been heard before. And like Tom said, it was almost like, you know, a little like the minor leagues, where if you got a chance to have a song in the Emo Diaries, it might propel you on to something else, or at least people might be talking about you a little bit more than before. So
I think that's completely true.
Yeah. Well, good.
Well, the Further Seems Forever, it's hilarious. If you see chapter 4, it says X Strong Arm, which I think is hilarious. Because who writes X Strong Arm anymore? But at that time, that's what it was.
Yeah.
The movie life's on there. And it's kind of fun. You look at all of them and pick out, like, wow, that band did it. Like, I was like trying to think of, you know, other compilations of, at the time, almost unknowns, or maybe there's a couple on there, but there's always one that kind of pops out that stays. And I think that's a really testament to the selection process and finding good songs.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there was definitely some, you know, there was chapters that I like more than others, but there was always good stuff in all the chapters, at least in my opinion. I mean,
and it's
funny, you brought up this Further Seems Forever. I was just totally forgot they were even on one of the Emo Diaries. But, you know, Deep Elm was like originally supposed to work with those guys. And I don't know what the story was. I mean, John told me it was like the drummer was a dick and there was some sort of... So, you know, it never worked out. But yeah, I mean, it is crazy to see some of the bands that actually did end up, you know, doing well on their own. So
what, because I will, I'm not aware of the selection process that you guys used in order to kind of weed stuff out with that. Was it basically just people sent in stuff and then, you know, you kind of just picked, you know, you guys collectively picked it from there? Or did you guys already have like, hey, these are 10 bands that like, you know, we just randomly ran across that we like, but we don't want to sign, you know, like how did that process go?
Maybe a little of both. I mean, we always had an open submission process, both for the Emo Diaries and for Deep Elm. So, I mean, a lot of it was just people sending in stuff, sending in demos in general, and we'd listen to everything. And, you know, usually, you know, the first pass, if we thought it, you know, if we thought it showed promise or we wanted to listen more, you know, we'd put it into one pile. And obviously there's a lot of stuff that was just, you know, crap that you'd throw away. And then, you know, out of the good stuff, you'd listen to it again. And maybe there was some stuff that was really good, but you didn't quite like it enough to want to put it out. But for those bands, you know, like, hey, we could put this, you know, maybe they want to put a song on the Emo Diaries because it is, you know, it is really good. And, you know, it, you know, maybe there's like one song that really stood out. And then, you know, from those demos, you know, occasionally there was a band that we just really, really liked, and maybe we'd kind of keep that, and maybe it would end up actually being, you know, part of the roster. But it was simple as that, you know, send in music, and, you know, we'll consider it for number one, Emo Diaries, and obviously we'll consider it for, you know, if we like it enough, maybe we'll put out the record.
I personally shit my pants when I got that call that you said you want to be on it. So,
see, it was like your highlight moment in when you were, I don't know how old you were, but
I mean, that was like, I was just moved to New York. I had this band, like it was that thing you needed. It was funny. The band was on two compilations and those things were the reason that we got to play shows, met other bands. It's funny that the compilation was the, you know, Spotify playlist or whatever the, you know, iTunes feature. That was the best way to get your name out there.
Yeah. Wait, so when you sent us music, was it a full length or did you just send like a bunch of songs?
I sent two songs.
Yeah. See, I mean, we get stuff like all the time. I mean, sometimes bands would send full records, you know, wanting to get signed to Deep Elm. And sometimes they would just send a song or two, you know, whether or not they wanted to do something on the Emo Diaries, or maybe they were just kind of making us aware of, you know, hey, we're out there, you should pay attention to us. But I mean, it was all sorts of different things. There was no digital submission at the time, which is, you know, interesting to remember a time when there wasn't any of that stuff. Cause now it's, you know, it's probably like, for all labels, it's probably like all digital submission. I mean, who wants to get, you know, who wants a stack of 50 promos that just laying around? But
I know Equal Vision still gets promos every day.
Is Equal Vision still doing stuff? I can't remember the last time. What are they releasing these days?
It's fine. My girlfriend still works there, which is hilarious. So I'm still connected. They did the We Came as Romans record. Isley, they're putting out the new Say Anything.
Really?
Yep. What else?
See, I feel like there's like big labels like Equal Vision and Victory, who I don't know if they just figure that they're, you know, maybe they have like a big enough fan base where you don't really see like reviews or much press coverage on those labels anymore. Like I was just thinking about Victory the other day, like what the hell are they doing now? But they're still around. I mean, they're still releasing stuff.
Ray, so, what's the big band? Is it A Day to Remember? Isn't that their band?
On Victory?
Yeah, I think it's A Day to Remember. I think that's keeping the lights. I mean, I think it's for them, when I was there, it was a band. I mean, just backstory. I mean, I worked at Equal Vision for 3 years. I feel like you had this tentpole band, and then you were able to kind of bring up other bands, and it wasn't like every band was popular, but you just had one band kind of carry it and help bring everybody else up, and tours and all that stuff.
And you know what? I'm sure Equal Vision and Victory are still doing quite well based on their back catalog too, which, you know, a label, you know, labels that have been around forever and have such a rich history of, you know, releasing pop. I don't know if I want to say popular records, but you know, records that kids really connect with. Maybe it's just, you know, Tony Brummel by himself, you know, reaping the benefits of his back catalog. I don't know, and occasionally releasing one or two new records. I don't know. It's just.
I know that. I mean, with EVR, a lot of the big thing is their merch company too. They have a huge merch thing. It's unbelievable. I've gone back there a couple times just to go to the office and hang, and just they keep adding more labels that they do merch for, more tours that they do merch for. It's just, you know, the adage, you know, you can't download a T-shirt.
Yeah.
That definitely was a big deal, and it just it's actually a really, really cool story. I give Steve, the guy that owns it, is a huge credit for you know, taking it and trusting people and kind of expanding it. So, but yeah, it going back to, you know, the sort of the Deep Elm. I mean, I feel like those bands popped out, and either you knew them from that, or you saw the tour and you did sort of some research on them and you found out they were on a comp or they were on the label. A lot of those bands in that time frame kind of you came back to Deep Elm, and that's how you started searching. That's how you started buying, like you guys said, you know, you buy records on a whim.
Yeah.
And yeah, you sort of trust the label. You trust, I mean, there is a fan base of EVR, there's a fan base of Rev, there's a fan base of Century Media, there's a fan base of Deep Elm, I feel like, definitely during those years.
I mean, I think that's a good point, that, you know, any label, any independent label that becomes moderately successful is usually, you know, it's based on the fact that their fan base, like you said, they trust what they released. And there's lots of kids who just continue, you know, no matter what they put out, they'll continue to buy, you know, to buy most of it, which is great. You know, I mean, that's, if you're a label, that's, at least these days, that's one of the, that's how you can survive. I mean, not even, I mean, and coming from Tiny Engine's perspective, we're, you know, mm-hmm. we're just a hobby, and our goal is, you know, our goal is only to, you know, break even or maybe make a little money to be self-sustaining, where we can just continue to put, you know, record sales into future records. So, but you know, we don't have like a ton of mail order customers. We do all right, but there's definitely a lot of kids who buy multiple releases from us, and that's definitely great to have, to know that we have like a small but a solid fan base who supports us like that. And then, you know, like there's, you know, like you said, Equal Vision, just really branching out and trying other things. You know, it's a tough world for labels out there now. I mean, it's especially considering that bands can do a lot of the stuff on their own. And
you basically, as a label, you basically have like two choices. One, to either obviously just like, you know, kill any whatever brand identity you have and be able to, you know, like you said, expand your horizon, sign different bands that don't sound like what you've done before, or you can kind of do, you know, whatever, like No Idea. And like, there's not many labels that have that sort of, oh, it comes out on this, so it must be good anymore. Because it's like, you know, obviously, like we're referencing like the mid to late 90s, you could trust certain labels where it's like, dude, whatever they're putting out, I will probably like, and I will definitely buy. But now it's like, you know, it's such a, labels such as yourself, you know, Tiny Engines, it's like you guys have the ability to do that because, you know, you're not relying on this as your main source of income, where it's like, hey, we can release bands that fall under the same umbrella and you probably will like this if you like this.
Yeah, no, exactly. And we never had any, you know, grand illusions that we were going to become a full-time label. Yeah, working at Deep Elm taught me enough to know that it just wasn't possible, and I don't even know if I'd ever really want to do that again. I mean, it's a lot of pressure to keep your label alive, or, you know, just you're constantly trying to figure out, you know, new ways to sell records and to introduce kids to the music and get new kids on board. And
you also have to figure out how much cocaine to buy too.
Yeah, it's totally.
That's the only way to get it on the radio.
But yeah, with Tiny Engines, it was just at the beginning, you know, Will and I, and then there's another guy, Jeff, we just kind of said, you know, we want this to be fun. We want it to succeed, and we want to continue to be able to release records. So obviously there's some element that, you know, we need to sell stuff, but ultimately, you know, I just want the whole process to be fun. I want to work with bands that we really love. I want to spend a little bit of extra money on cool packaging and cool vinyl colors. And, you know, I just don't, and because it's a hobby, I don't necessarily have to worry about, you know, failing. Although, you know, we also don't want to put our own money into the label. I mean, we do, but it would be nice that we, like I said, if it could be self-sustaining.
You don't want to put your kids' college education on Tiny Engines. You can just spend it all.
My wife definitely does not want to do that either. I wish she was here because I should have her talk about Tiny Engines and how much she loves it. every time I'm working on something Tiny Engines, she's like, "Why aren't you doing something that actually makes money?"
Wow.
Okay.
You know, Chuck, I think just from Bear Trap, I mean, that kind of came out of your love of working some of the same bands. And it's funny how that each of these things kind of comes out of loving the music and it ends up working.
Yeah, I mean, now we're finally expanding outside of the Bear Trap roster. But when we first started Tiny Engines, we were like, oh, we don't want it to be just, well, I mean, obviously there were some Bear Trap bands that we really loved and we loved, you know, we wanted to work with them, but we said, you know, let's not make this a Bear Trap label. But I mean, that's what it actually ended up being for like the first four or five releases. And now it's sort of, see, it's hard for me to say where the label is right now. Like, I feel we're doing well. I mean, probably not well enough. You know, we can't just release anything we want to release, and we still can't release, you know, more than four or five things a year. But, you know, I like where we're heading, and I like the bands we're working with, and, you know, it's most importantly, it's been fun. Like, I've really enjoyed the whole process of making vinyl records, which we never did vinyl at Deep Elm. If we did do vinyl, it was always licensing it out to other labels. So I, you know, 7-8 years at Deep Elm, and I had no clue about the whole process of making vinyl. So it's been eye opening, but I've really enjoyed it. So.
And Bear, just so I'm correct in this, Bear Trap is like obviously your full-time gig and that's what you spend most of your time on?
Yeah, I mean, Bear Trap is my quote-unquote paying.
Your bread and butter.
But I stay home with the kids. I have, you know, two little boys who are like 3.5 and 1.5. So I really don't get much Bear Trap stuff done during the day. So right now it's almost like Bear Trap's a part-time job and, you know, being daddy daycare is my full-time job. So, that, in that respect, it's been interesting, but I think once, you know, it's at the point where I'm definitely not lacking for any projects. I mean, it's been good that we've built up a solid enough reputation where, I mean, bands find us. I don't have to go out and look for bands to work with. And it's, you know, mostly all word of mouth and referral from other bands we've worked with. And that's good too, because it's usually, you know, there's a lot of really cool bands that contact us. And that's the number one, you know, my number one priority is to work music I like. I mean, I turn down a lot of stuff because I can't bring myself to work something just for a paycheck, you know? Although maybe I should. But yeah, I mean, right now Bear Trap's, you know, full time minus the time I put in with the kids. And then, you know, and then I've got Bear Trap and Tiny Engines, and it's definitely a full life. And I think, I don't know, we'll see when the kids are old enough to go to school full time, how things progress. I mean, I feel like I have, you know, I think we're doing well enough where, you know, I'll never be rich. You know, I'll probably never make any more than, you know, the high school teacher. But, you know, at least I get to work from home and I get to do what I want. And, you know, it's my own thing, and it's definitely been fun. So I can't complain, really.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And I know we Tom and I kind of wanted to ask some more general questions in regards to, you know, connecting it back to the website and just kind of, you know, focusing it on emo, as it were, as a genre. When, you know, for you, when did you first start to notice that emo obviously had shifted meanings and, you know, it started to become, there was a lot of negative connotations that were attached to it?
Oh, man. I think there was, I mean, working at Deep Elm, I feel like there was always sort of a negative connotation with emo. It always seemed like we were fighting that fight to make emo cool. And then all of a sudden, at some point, you know, you're getting bands like Dashboard Confessional and, I don't know, like some of the bands that became really big and had some mainstream success, which is great. I mean, nothing, I don't want to take anything away from those bands, but they were being portrayed as emo, you know, like bands like Fall Out Boy. And that wasn't necessarily the emo I was, you know, I would never call those bands emo, really.
Which is the catalyst for the washed up emo.
It was just weird. Like, okay, we're supposed to be this emo label, but we aren't really reaping the benefits of any of this stuff. But I don't think we really ever paid all that much attention to it. I think everybody else probably paid more attention to it than we did. And we just sort of, you know, we went with it. We were like, well, you know, if people call us an emo label, that's fine. But we're going to release stuff that we like. And if it's emo, that's cool. If it's, you know, if it's something else, then that's just what we're going to do. And then I don't know. It's in the past couple of years, it seemed like, I mean, emo is obviously people use the term all the time who have no clue where it came from. You know, it's just funny to hear it, you know, in like a sitcom or, you know, in reference to like some kid who cuts himself. I'm just like, what? But now it's almost like there's bands that are bringing back that old school emo sound, like Algernon and, you know, bands like that, and now it's almost like emo is cool again. Like the underground emo that I like, that, you know, that I would associate with emo, it's almost like it's not made fun of now. And I don't know what happened, where the turning point was exactly.
I feel it was like 2 years ago, there started to be those bands, and they were saying, you know, I'm not referencing Fall Out Boy, I'm referencing Mineral. I'm referencing Promise Ring. And there enough time had passed, I feel like, where they were older, and they were younger, but they didn't like what they were supposed to at that time, what was pop, which was the bad emo. And then they sort of found those bands kind of organically. And it was just – it's funny. I mean, I remember there's this band Gates from New Jersey, which a friend sent me the record. I was blown away. I was like, is this 1998? But it sounded new, and it sounded like they had a little Mogwai in it, and they just brought like a few other things to it. And it just really resonated that, holy crap, like bands are – I was like, it's finally coming around. And it's – and I think – I don't know. I think for me it was 2 years ago that I felt like it was okay to say that word.
Maybe not so much. Like, I mean, I agree with you 100%, because obviously a lot of these bands, you know, bands like Title Fight, Balance and Composure, where it's like they reference all of those bands that we were speaking of. But to me, it seems like it falls under the banner of post-hardcore. I mean, which obviously at the end of the day, it doesn't fucking matter. It's good music. But because I personally don't see that word, you know, no band obviously uses that to describe themselves, or, you know, you don't really see it in one sheets or anything like that.
No, you're right. Post-hardcore is the new way to say it.
Yeah, no, that's like, yeah, it's definitely the altered way of like, all right, we don't want to sound like little kids' music, even though realistically it's like, I think most people that would look at that word now would reference it towards obviously something bad, but who knows? Maybe the word, obviously, in like 5 years, you know, bands will start to embrace it more and be, you know, confident with that.
Can we think about post-hardcore, the word, for a second again? I'm like laughing to myself. Whenever I thought of post-hardcore, it was the dudes in hardcore bands doing bands after. That was post-hardcore to me. Like,
yeah.
Quicksand was after, you know, Youth of Today. Okay, now that's what he's doing. That's post-hardcore. That's his band.
Yeah. Well, that's like, it's just, it's so easy to lump that term on anything that basically it's like, well, it's kind of aggressive, but they don't scream, so it's after hardcore. It's after. That's what it is.
And you know what? Now that you mentioned post-hardcore, I am recalling that that was pretty much, I believe, the word we used in all our bios to replace emo.
Amazing.
Find and replace.
Yeah. And because I wrote most of the Deep Elm bios all that time. So, you know, you'd always be – I remember at the beginning, first couple of years, you'd be really cautious. You wouldn't want to mention the word emo in the bio. So it would be. It'd be post-hardcore is what we'd use. And I think towards the end, we started, you know, we were like, whatever, we'll just say emo. But that's totally true. We totally – those words were like interchangeable, even though, you know, do they really even mean the same thing? But post-hardcore was like the tough way of saying emo.
Yeah. And like some of the bands, I mean, it's funny, the DJ night that we do once a month here, it says emo/post-hardcore because – if you just say emo, people are going to think one thing. But if you throw in post-hardcore, they'll be like, okay, they can play Taking Back Sunday for us, you know, or whatever. It's just like, even
it's
though.
Taking Back Sunday post-hardcore?
I'm just saying, it just helps. I'm just saying people can at least feel more comfortable saying other bands.
Yeah.
Because sometimes if you just say emo, they're like, all right, well, they're just going to play stuff that makes you want to cut yourself.
Yeah.
And
see, but, you know, like I always thought of post-hardcore. I mean, I see exactly what you're saying, but. You know, when I thought of the word post-hardcore, I would actually think about bands like Quicksand mm-hmm. that were, you know, they were based in hardcore, but then they were sort of had this, you know, emotional slant to them. And that was still kind of cool. You know, it wasn't like it wasn't full out emo. It was like hardcore, but it was sort of sensitive, too. And you know, it was OK to like that sort of music. Like it was OK to like Quicksand.
I felt at the drive-in kind of fell into that, but they were more angular, more the indie side, that they yeah. kind of went that direction instead of straight ahead verse, chorus, verse, breakdown, chorus times two.
No, they're post-hardcore, okay? Just leave it at that. All right.
All right, Ray has spoken.
Yeah. No, I'm labeling everything. Guns N' Roses, post-hardcore.
Fat Axel or Skinny Axel?
That's true. Later Guns N' Roses, post-hardcore.
There you go.
That's awesome. I just, Chuck, was there any kind of fun memories from Mac Rock? I know Mac Rock was this, just for people, those a conference that was the Mid-Atlantic conference of, you know, college radio stations from, you know, Virginia, Maryland, North Carolina, South Carolina, and I remember I would that fest was a weekend run by WXJM in Harrisonburg, Virginia, and it was just I would see bands there the year before they would play CMJ or South by Southwest. I felt it was like such an exciting few years, and I know you guys were down there, and I would get to go down there for work stuff. Was there any kind of fun stuff you remember? And I mean, for me, the first band I ever saw open the fest in, I think it was 97, was the Get Up Kids.
Uh-huh.
They were the first band on.
Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, just I just popped in my head that I think I have a picture of you and I somewhere in a pile of pictures at the Label Expo. I should dig that up and scan it.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, I mean, Mac Rock was always it sort of got progressively worse for me, but the first couple years, the first year I just had a total blast, and I ended up staying with a girl who went to James Madison, who was like a friend.
Who's I have like a photo of her.
I don't know if it's that girl. Or, I don't know. Maybe it is.
There was a lot of girls, right? Let's just move on. Chuck, continue.
She was like a friend of the best friend of one of my brother's good friends who went to school in West Virginia. It was just really random, and I was just like poor and needed a place to crash. And I mean, there was nothing like particularly notable about that night, except we just, you know, we hung out at a couple bars and just had like a really, really good time. And she was just like a really gracious host. And I think that, you know, I had a good time at all the shows and stuff, but I think that sort of added to the whole weekend that, you know, I could just meet this random person and just have like a really, you know, a solidly fun time. And then, you know, the next couple of years it was, you know, it was fun. And I don't know what it was, but the last 2 years I went just weren't really doing it for me. I mean, I remember one of the last years I went up for Deep Elm and we set up a booth at the label expo. I mean, everybody was buying vinyl and we had no vinyl. And I think I sold like 2 CDs the whole time, which was just weird. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it was because I was younger and just didn't really give a crap that I had such a great time. And then later on I was older and grumpier, but there's no doubt there were some great memories. I mean, nothing, I never did anything like super crazy, but just in general the experience was always pretty good. And
well,
I know they're still doing it, and I wish I could get back up there again, but it's hard with kids now, you know. It's, you can't just do those weekend getaway trips. So
well, I'll definitely
look back on those times with fondness.
Yeah, I went to the 10-year, and it was just, you know, you could just see it moving to another way, and it wasn't as organic. I mean, you stayed with people from campus. Like, if you're in a band, you went up and you play, or you stayed with them at their house. And it was just kind of that sort of community aspect of it that I really missed.
Yeah.
I think that's indicative of fests in general. Like during the 90s, like, you know, you had your Hellfest up in New York and, you know, Crazy Fest from Initial Records in Louisville. And it's like all those same things, you know, exactly what Chuck was saying, where it was like, yeah, the bands were awesome and it gave everybody a reason to be there. But then it was always about the, you know, connections that you made with people, where it's like, I just met you today and you are awesome and we like the same bands. And it's like that, you know. I really, really, really hope that it's like, you know, kids that are coming up now, you know, a place like Warped Tour. Obviously, there's a much less sense of community there, but I hope that in some way, shape, or form, they're able to have those experiences that we had, where it's like, you know, you just randomly run into a person and like hang out with them at Warped Tour all day, and then, you know, you're best friends on Facebook or, you know, whatever medium.
Common ground of music.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I hope that exists in some way, shape, or form, because obviously I know we all have such fond memories based off that fact.
Yeah, and Ray, I don't know if you know this one random story. I'll make fun of myself, and there's actually video of this. There was a year that Spitfire played, and it was supposed to be their last show. They played the big room. It was, I don't know, 2,000 kids were in there. I mean, it was some stupid amount of people, and I knew a couple guys in the band. The drummer, his girlfriend was at the school I went to. Anyway, they knew my favorite band was Helmet. So they literally started, they didn't tell me. I'm on the side of the stage hanging. And all of a sudden they start going into In the Meantime. And the singer hands me the mic. And I forgot every word.
Oh, amazing.
And so literally I do the chorus. And the lead singer didn't know the lyrics either. So literally they played an instrumental version of In the Meantime with me crowd surfing and screaming because I didn't know the words. And literally, like, the video is so cringeworthy that I was like, at some point I'll bring it out and I'll rip it and put it up on YouTube. But that's like whenever someone says Mac Rock, like, my head instantly remembers the mic dropping as I try to pick it up while 2,000 kids are watching me screw up a song.
So good.
See, I never had one of those experiences.
I think it's good that you didn't.
Yeah, seriously.
You know what? The year that Fugazi played,
that was awesome.
You know, and that year, my wife, well, she was my girlfriend at the time, came up with me, and we were either going to the show or maybe going to the hotel, and I blew a tire and. So I had to pull over to like the Mac or the like a McDonald's parking lot, and I didn't have a spare tire. I can't remember what happened, but anyways, I missed the show. So it was like my one chance to see Fugazi, and I, you know, totally, God said no. So I don't know.
Did you go to his panel? Did you miss that?
I don't think I did. I don't think I ever really went to a panel. Probably because weren't the label expos – wasn't the label expo going on?
Same time.
And yeah, so I don't think I ever really went to a panel, which was too bad. I mean
– it was funny. He spoke in front of – I mean there was 250 people in this like classroom, but he literally had this open conversation with people. It was one of the – I mean it's just kind of funny that we're talking about him and his sort of bands supposedly sparking a lot of this genre, Rites of Spring, Embrace. I mean that – but it's just funny that he was so he's so smart in hearing him speak and speaking like not with a mic and kids just yelling out stuff to him and him responding and being that young and seeing that was just like, okay, he knows what he's doing, he's done it, and you should probably listen.
I would never. I'm not the type of person that has like a lot of like punk rock heroes, but Ian MacKaye. You know, every time I read an interview or, you know, see a video, I'm always like, he is the smartest person in punk rock I know. And not like smart, like I agree with it. He just like very well thought out and things he says I agree with. And you know, I don't really know him personally, but I remember at Deep Elm when we were switching our distro to Southern, who carried Discord, John talked to Ian. He was very helpful. And I think at one point we even sent him a bunch of records and he sent us back like a postcard, you know, saying thank you, you know, blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's just, you know, if for all you kids out there, if you want someone to look up to, I think, you know, Ian MacKaye is definitely a great choice. You know, he's, I just really appreciate the things he says and the way he's obviously run that label and run his bands over the years.
Yeah, I saw him about 2 years ago. He did like a West Coast spoken word tour. Mm-hmm. And there was like 400 people packed in this like tiny room at a University of California at Irvine. And same sort of experience I imagine you had, Tom, at Mac Rock, where it's like he just got up there, you know, he taught like I was in the front of the room just being like, okay, I pray to God that no kid asks him about Straight Edge, because it's like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, and of course some kid's like, hey, what are your thoughts on modern Straight Edge? And it's like, oh God. I mean, he handled himself like very appropriately, but I was like, if I were him, I'd be like, shut up, I'm not talking to you. But yeah, I definitely think that he's a person that people should, look towards and reference, and obviously sparking so many musical genres out of something that they just did because they were kids.
Yeah.
Sort of in conclusion from my end, and obviously if Tom has any additional questions, with the, you know, seeing how, you know, Warped Tour and Alternative Press and a lot of these different, musical outlets have, you know, paid homage to, you know, emo and the bands that they've, that have come up in that era. And kids are obviously becoming more aware of those bands. You know, Chuck, where do you personally kind of see this headed, not only as a person that obviously, you know, works in publicizing it, but then works as far as a label as well. So like, you know, what sort of trends do you see coming up within that? And if anything at all, or avoiding the trends?
That's such a tough question. I don't even know. You know, sometimes I feel like I should just not concern myself with any of this stuff. I mean, obviously you have to be connected to it. You know, if you're running a PR company, you need to be connected to the things that are going on within the scene. But, you know, the way I run Bear Trap and the way, you know, we run Tiny Engines, you know, the only thing I can really be super concerned about is, do I believe in the bands that I'm working with? Do I think they're worthy of a bigger audience? Do I think more people should hear these bands? And you know, how can I help do that? I mean, how can I get the word out there? And I think at the end of the day, you know, I mean, good music really, I mean, that's sort of the bottom line. And I can't necessarily, you know, concern myself with other factors like that. I mean, you know, obviously you have to keep up with social trends like Facebook and Twitter and, you know, stay on top of that sort of thing. And obviously the whole social media thing is a big, you know, that seems to be pretty huge. But even in the way I run Bear Trap, a lot of it is still like the old school way. Like if someone gives me a phone number, a lot of times I'll call them and touch base with them that way. And I still work a lot of physical promos. You know, I know a lot of companies have sort of switched over to all digital, but I still think there's something to be said about sending somebody an actual record. I send people a lot of vinyl records. A lot of the bands I work with will give me vinyl promo copies, which I think is awesome because there's obviously people who love that sort of thing. And I don't know. It's just, I think it's finding a way to connect with other folks. And I don't know. Trends, again, that's a hard question. I don't know if that really answered it for you.
No. I mean, that makes sense. I think you hit on a good point where it's just like, because obviously the whole point of, you know, the site and the podcast is to, you know, highlight a musical genre that, you know, has changed over time and to ultimately, daddy,
yeah.
Yeah, that's fine. We welcome families. I'm holding my own child in front of me right now.
Is your child being quiet?
Yes, he is. He's 6 months old. He doesn't know how to talk yet, so it's good. But yes, to focusing on the fact that ultimately we're all intrinsically connected through music, and however people decide to do that these days, like you said, whether it's those, you know, Facebook, Twitter, whatever, or it is through places like alternative press and, you know, Warped Tour, ultimately that people have that connection and realize that there is stuff that came before them as well.
Yeah. I mean, and you mentioned, you know, going to Warped Tour, and you know, I think that's another thing that I think people are sort of missing out on. You know, the whole social media aspect. Sometimes I think people forget about going out to see a good show and connecting with people in that respect. And I'm guilty of it too, because I mean, well, number one, I'm you know, almost 36, and
you're practically dead.
You just sort of feel awkward going to shows where, you know,
you did miss the Hope's Fall shows.
I did miss the whole fall show. But when you're like 15 years older than everybody in the room and they're kind of looking at you like, is this guy a narc or something? It's just sort of weird. But I try and get out as much as I can. And, you know, I definitely know some kids out there that I see at every show. And but yeah, just I think it's important for people to go out and obviously support the bands when they are able to get out on the road. Because touring is obviously, it's really hard. You know, you don't make money, and you live in crappy conditions, and you got to deal with broken bands and all sorts of weird stuff. So people definitely need to get out and support the bands in that respect.
Cool. Did you have anything else, Tom, that you wanted to hit on?
Chuck, you're amazing.
Well, thanks. For some reason, I didn't know this was going to be like a Chuck Daly interview. I just thought we were just going to talk about shit, but no, it's cool. You know, I don't normally like talk about my history that much, so I'll just point to this podcast if anybody wants to know where I came from.
Well, that's sort of the idea of this was, you know, these people that have kind of come in my life and Ray's life that I feel like have such, you know, impact on me and what I've obviously the emo diaries, and just I think these stories are, I think, going to be interesting to hear for people that are coming up and listening to this genre and finding out the history. And I hope people get something out of it.
Yeah. It's funny because every time you guys would mention something, it would make something in my brain click about some story I had. So, I mean, I'm sure we could probably sit here for hours and just bullshit about, you know, old days.
That's the hardest part about these, the medium of podcasting, because it's just like, before you know it, it's like we've been online for an hour and 17 minutes, and it's like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, that's a long time, dude. So
yeah, and we've only talked about me, so
well, because Tom and I will have plenty of time to speak.